Welcome to Leaders and Legends of Online Learning, a podcast dedicated to the experts. Thank you for listening. Each episode, we'll be learning from the world's leading thinkers and practitioners in online learning and linking to ideas relevant to online teaching, working with online learners, and digital education. You can listen to the experts and check their profiles and link to some of their work on our website, www.onlinelearninglegends.com. I'm Mark Nichols, the interviewer in this episode. You'll meet Associate Professor Cheryl Hodgkinson-Williams in this episode. Cheryl is UNESCO Chair in Open Education and Social Justice and a member of the Staff Development Team at the University of Cape Town in South Africa. She has a very interesting history in ICT and open education. Cheryl and I talked via Skype. I'm talking today with Associate Professor Cheryl Hodgkinson-Williams, a member of the Staff Development Team at the University of Cape Town. Cheryl's areas of expertise include educational technology and open education. Cheryl, it's really good to include you as a legend and leader of online learning.
Thank you very much.
Can we start with a brief overview of your career and publications?
Okay, so in fact, I started my career as a primary school teacher, but I didn't stay there for long, and I was lured into the corporate world of what was then called computer-based instruction. That offered me a brand new insight into how to use technology for teaching and learning. I mean, that time, which was the mid-80s, what we were using were mainframe computers with little dumb terminals, but yet we were actually using them quite creatively to basically have drill and practice exercises. And I was in charge of a full primary school curriculum teaching Afrikaans, which was my subject when I taught, to the entire primary school group. It was my first experience with using technology. We used to still have mini computers at the schools, little deck computers that we used to actually change IP boards. So from then I migrated to another computer-based company, which was actually much more focused on industry and the military in particular. So I had some experience there of developing materials for a very different audience. Then I made a move into the academic heart, to the University of the Witwatersrand, where I did some online learning work, but it was still very early days then, but mostly staff training. But I did continue my postgraduate education while I was at WITS, and then I received a promotion within WITS and decided to study, do a master's at the University of Pretoria in what was then called computer-based instruction. And from then, I actually was asked to join the team at the University of Pretoria, where for just under 5 years, I taught both undergraduates, computer literacy, and postgraduates a master's in, it was then computer-based instruction. I subsequently started a PhD, completed it, and then had an opportunity to move to Rhodes University in Grahamstown, where for 9 years, I taught from the advanced diploma level right through to PhD supervision. My focus there was primarily on the use of ICTs in schools. One of the papers that's most often cited is one that was part of a research study undertaken in the schools on behalf of the local provincial government, looking at interactive whiteboards. One of our research respondents had said, well, interactive whiteboards are not real beauty, they're just lipstick. It was part of her response to our questions, and that title we used in a paper, which I think, if I'm correct, is the most often cited paper that I undertook with my colleagues, Hannah Tignani and Ingrid Seaborger. And then my husband and I, he had got an opportunity to come down to University of Cape Town, so I moved here basically without a job, and then joined my colleague Eve Gray in a research project on open access materials and gradually into open education resources. And that was kind of 2007. And I have been in the kind of open education resource area as a speciality ever since then.
I'm really interested in the transition from computer-based instruction into the online world. So I think the internet was sort of taking place in the background of your story, wasn't it, as your career advanced. When did online education first appear on your radar?
In fact, it appeared quite early because I was one of the students in the first cohort of teacher education at Rhodes University, where I undertook my undergraduate degree. We used Pilot to program mathematics lessons for our children. We also used Seymour Papert's Turtle, because I think that really cemented ideas of agency around how you could actually use this technology to make it do things for you rather than to you, if you get my differentiations. I mean, there's some learning management systems like Moodle that actually had a pedagogic intent. But many of the educational uses of technology are just piggybacking on general purpose technologies that were probably designed for slightly different purposes. So we're, I think, in this whole area of ICTs and education, or sometimes what is called educational technology, which is a little bit of a challenge, because I don't know if that there is such a thing. The technology is almost running ahead of the applications that we're dreaming up. And we're sometimes starting with a technology and looking around for a problem that it can actually solve, rather than having an educational need and then developing technologies to assist that. It's improving a little now with kind of more dedicated educational apps, but it's still got that underlying kind of technological determinism, which I think we've got to guard against all the time.
Yeah, that's really interesting, that, because I'd imagine back in the early days of computer-based instruction, the aspiration was much more than the technology could actually deliver. But somewhere things have reversed. I think we've got more capability now, but perhaps not as much by way of actual pedagogical ideas to help take that technology forward.
Yes, and I can actually attest to that with one really sweet example, which came about in my first job when I was using these mainframes to teach with these dumb terminals. So you had to kind of hard code everything. And because I was teaching primary school, I had strategies that I wanted to use, but I couldn't make it work always. But I did dream up one little strategy of having a crossword puzzle. And I was determined to make it work, and I got it nearly there, and then I hit one problem. So I contacted the original developers, who were Stanford and in Israel, and they told me it was absolutely impossible to do. So I said, well, I've kind of got nearly there to the end, I just need the last piece. And they said, please send us your code, because you have absolutely no idea what you've done. When they saw it, they did. They just made the final little technical leap for me. But it was just in their imagination. They had never thought of their program being used in a way like that. So it took somebody like me, who'd had really minimal exposure to computing, but with quite a vivid imagination of what you wanted, to kind of highlight a new affordance. So I think sometimes we don't know how these tools can work, and maybe we hold on to our educational imagination. That's going to serve us well. Otherwise, we just get overwhelmed by the tools. And, you know, you find people, I mean, I suppose I'm even guilty myself, talking about, oh, let's blog, rather than let's reflect on what we've learned in class or what we've done together in a project. So I've actually started changing the tool names in our learning management system. I've started changing the tool name blog to whatever I want it to be, whether it's some kind of individual reflection or group reflection, because otherwise we land up with the tool dominating. That I think, is worrisome.
It's really interesting. So I think from your CBI background, and particularly your exposure to Seymour Papert's work, I think you're used to seeing technology in a certain context as a means to an educational end rather than something to be distracted by and somehow incorporate.
Absolutely. And I was fortunate enough to meet Seymour Papert himself. Even in about an hour and a half we had with him, my colleague Johannes Cronier and I was just aware I was kind of meeting a great. I didn't fully understand how great. He certainly understood the power of technology, but because of that, he handled it very gently. He asked us more questions about education and questioned why technology would actually be a useful tool. It was almost as if he was really trying to help us argue why a technological tool was needed for an educational end. And I find myself now in many ways, when students or even other colleagues start with, oh, well, let's use this tool to do X, Y, Z, I always come back to, so what is it you're trying to achieve? Because sometimes the tool that people see is not actually going to meet that end, because they haven't perhaps used it fully enough to realize how it might constrain in unexpected ways. It's a theme that I've carried throughout my teaching and supervision career.
Can we flick on to your work to do with open education? So I think that's a lot more informed by the online possibilities, isn't it? Can you give us a bit of an overview of your work there?
So in my move from Rhodes to UCT, the bridge was I came for a sabbatical here at the end of 2006 and met up with Eve Gray. She's a publisher by profession, and she'd been doing a lot of work in open access with open access journals, etc. And forging these new ideas ahead. And when I finally came to UCT, I linked up with her in a project that was actually looking generally at how ICTs in higher education could be supporting the kind of key pillars of higher education in terms of the teaching and learning and research and community engagement. So that was the first project in which we got involved. We were actually funded by the Shuttleworth Foundation for this project, and we both were invited to the deliberations that actually finally landed up being the Cape Town Open Education Declaration. So we were part of an absolutely amazing group from all over the world, a team of amazing people there putting together that Cape Town Open Education Declaration. And actually from then it was like we moved to one project that just pushed this OER agenda forward. So we had a follow-up project in which was also funded by the Shuttleworth Foundation, which gave us funding to develop what we called a referatory, but it was really a kind of curation space for UCT lecturers to link materials they had already made online, because despite the fact that we only named OER as OER in 2002, at least it was a UNESCO term that they devised, the practice of sharing openly had actually been happening all along. It's, in fact, it's what teachers and lecturers do all the time. It's just not necessarily public, and it's not necessarily legally open with a license attached to it. So we found quite a number of people who were very keen on sharing their materials, which they had already been sharing for ages, but just now more openly. So, and from that project, there were a couple of other spin-off projects. And then I was asked to be part of a steering committee for a new project run by the Canadian International Development Research Centre. They run out of Ottawa. And what we call Phase Zero was already in process. People looking to do research on OER in the Global South, because up until that point, most of the research was actually undertaken in the Global North, primarily in the US, but also in Europe, the UK, Australia, a little bit of New Zealand.
Yeah.
So it was a completely underdeveloped area. And I don't know, I perhaps was too enthusiastic. I was on sabbatical and I didn't realize I was looking for a project lead. So I became the principal investigator of what turned out to be a very big project called the Research on Open Education Resources for Development. And it spanned 21 countries, literally from the Philippines right across Asia, with Mongolia, Afghanistan, Pakistan, through Africa, into South America, Brazil, Colombia, Uruguay, Paraguay, and into Chile. So we had quite a big project, and it grew initially from 11 projects to 18 sub-projects because we were able to secure additional funding from DFID at that point. And we brought in our partners in Malaysia at the Wawasan Open University in Penang, so that the two universities worked together to try and manage the relatively big admin load that this took. But at the end, we produced the final reports. We did have all 18 final reports, and then from that we selected 13 for the book, and then we wrote three other chapters, sort of meta-level synthesis chapters. And I think that was probably, I don't know if the biggest project I will do, but it was 5 years from beginning to end. But it has really been the benchmark and baseline that people can take for a subsequent research. And that's what people are doing. So we're really excited about that. We also were very brave in making, where we could and where the consent was approved, to make some of our data open. So we have now 7 or 8 open data sets as well, which was a big step for us. And we also tried to almost walk the talk of open research at the same time as researching open education resources. We kind of put into practice what people now are aspiring towards. We've done and have learned a lot of lessons and are still learning lessons.
Is that still informing your own research activity?
At the moment, I am an advisor on a follow-up program which is called Digital Open Textbooks for Development, DOTFID. That's also funded by the IDRC and is primarily a small implementation program at UCT where lecturers and senior students have had to bid for money for creating or adapting open textbooks. And it's been really fascinating. I think there are about 18 applications in all. My colleague Glenda Cox is leading this program, and they've been able to award 9 grants. So as we speak, we have lecturers and senior students busy preparing their online textbooks. So we look forward to seeing that, so we can get a bit more of a critical mass of open textbooks that come from a South African position.
Excellent.
Otherwise, we constantly have ones that are written from very different contexts. And then we've been fortunate enough to team up with our government in higher education, and we just started a project looking at the readiness of the technical and vocational education and training institutions and their readiness for open education, and a few higher education institutions. We'll have about 16 case studies there as well. And we're busy doing a number of MOOCs. One of the most recent ones that we're doing is for inclusion of students with disabilities, and it's focused on teachers teaching students with disabilities. And one is up already, and that's on the Coursera platform. Even though it's on Coursera, it is an open education resource. So our division, the Center for Innovation, Teaching and Learning, is committed as far as possible to making online learning and MOOCs and online textbooks openly licensed with a Creative Commons license wherever possible.
Cheryl, as we talk, it's mid-2019. I'm wondering if you can just comment on your observations about online learning and education at the present time.
Okay, so I think the benefits is that we've now got like almost ubiquitous access, in at least in developed countries. Developing countries, a little less so, and particularly in rural environments, especially our studies in Africa and also in India. The challenge is that at the moment, and I'm talking materials now, not necessarily the technology, at the moment most of our materials are still available in English. And even if you say, well, people can translate them, this is true, but that means that the person who's translating, say for example it's a teacher in Pakistan or as we have in Afghanistan, teachers needing to translate materials into a local Dari or Pashto, that means they have got to have quite a high competence in English to be translating well. And the other challenge is a lot of the materials are in English and they still carry with them quite a kind of hegemonic Western perspective of what is considered valuable knowledge. So we've got a sort of cultural relevance issue that we've got to look at. And I think in terms of that, we've also got technologies, although they are ubiquitous and we have got opportunities to share, it's almost like we're perhaps missing local voices that might be drowned out, which is the one challenge. And then I have a slightly dystopian view of the role of these big publishing companies. No names mentioned, but there are companies that are now producing not only just the teaching materials, as in the books, but they're producing PowerPoint slides that go with them, or simulations that go with them, assessment tools that go with them. And it's making it quite easy for people to get kind of sucked into a package deal. The challenge with that is that unwittingly it's almost like the publishing companies are now starting to dominate what is considered as valuable knowledge and what the underlying curriculum is. For me, that's a bit worrying, because if we are only producing people who have a very kind of technicist, industry-specific background, they just might not be the kind of visionaries that we're hoping to develop in, certainly in higher education.
There's a lot of really rich themes there. So, I mean, certainly echoing through that is the commodification of education, potentially, especially as large publishers become involved. I'm personally quite disturbed when we use the word content to describe what it is that we actually teach to students. When in actual fact, it's rich ideas and new ways of thinking. I'm really intrigued by your mention of the dominant language being English. Do you think we're making any progress here? Are there some opportunities that technology might provide us to help address that problem?
Yes, and just drawing on some research done in Afghanistan in our project, the project there was to develop a library of materials associated with the curriculum, but in Dari or Pashto, and an NGO, Canadian Women for Afghan Women, and the local environment, people from Afghanistan themselves, they worked together. And what they did was actually tap into the kind of Afghan diaspora to get people in a sort of crowdsourcing strategy to volunteer to translate materials. So they were giving their time freely. And of course, they did have a project manager and editor who was checking the quality of the translations. I think having access to other people's thinking around the world, so that we have like a plurality of epistemic assumptions, so that we've got different ways of understanding what knowledge is, I think might help us overcome our current focus where we've kind of got different factions around the world not really understanding each other's perspectives. And I think having, right from school level, opportunities to read different perspectives on the same thing would really help us appreciate the value of interrogating ideas from more than one perspective.
Cheryl, I'm very interested in your response to this next question. What research would you most like to see at the moment?
Okay, so there are two things. Obviously, it's kind of extension of research that we're already doing in open education more broadly, not just open education resources, because I'm much more appreciative now of the kinds of practices that underpin open education resources. So you've got to be doing quite a lot of either collaborative work or making sure that you are thinking through where you might put things online so that they are easily shared, that underpin the open education resource development.
Yeah.
I'm interested in actually how people are doing this and what still continue to be barriers and where we might learn interesting lessons, like the one, for example, in Afghanistan. The second thing I think is a big one, and that is how we can certify in some way, badges or something, the kinds of learning that people have been able to undertake in a kind of self-directed way.
Yeah.
Because unless there is some way in which people can get recognition for the work they've done in a MOOC or the way they have been able to learn from a range of different open education resources online to present themselves for an exam on a particular topic, I think we're not going to see the benefit of all the open work. And are we still going to tie the teaching and the assessment together? It's like the image I use is when people obtain a driver's license. You can learn from your mum, as I did, or you can go to a driver's school. But at the end of the day, you decide when you're ready to have your driver's license. And it doesn't matter where you learnt it, but the license itself, and it's obviously different in different jurisdictions.
Yeah,
I think that they will be slightly different, but I think the nationally and internationally, they've got to look at much stronger mechanisms for this. Because otherwise, it's almost we're not going to see the optimal value of open education.
Yeah, so at the moment, of course, to receive an accredited qualification, you do need to enrol at a university, don't you? But what you're suggesting is if we can develop some form of perhaps parallel system whereby there are still some forms of assessment that a student needs to pass, it doesn't matter how they get there, as long as they actually meet the standards that are required.
Yeah, that's the bottom line. I mean, it's also similar to some of the professional associations, you know, for medicine, for example. It's the College of Fellows, and for accounting, you know, you write the board exam. You know, we have got precedents. It's not like we don't know how to do this. We do. And I'm not saying that's an easy thing, because it's very political in terms of who gets to choose what the assessment is. I mean, I'm very aware of that. But it's almost like if we don't do some separating, which my colleague Laura Tenuitz has talked about as unbundled, we run the risk of keeping a system, the same system in place. And currently we know that we have more learners in need of education, and particularly higher education, than we have places for. So unless we make some change, we're not going to be able to adequately serve those students with the current system we have anyway. So some thinking really needs to be done around how to accredit people for what they're doing. Otherwise, we're going to land up with people who are not going to be part of a system at all.
Cheryl, just to finish, two people you'd recommend as legends of online learning, one whose work or perspective is significantly influencing you perhaps at the moment, and someone else who you think otherwise has an important perspective to share.
So I think in terms of online learning, my colleague Sukaina Walji, we've talked together, worked together, and I really value her input around online learning. And then somebody who's influencing my work at the moment is a colleague at the University of the Western Cape, Professor Viv Bozalek. She has done some work in online learning, but I think she's a social worker by profession. And I think the value that I've gained from working with her is around social justice. And she uses the work of Nancy Fraser in particular to explore how and in what ways education can be more socially just. And I think that's the work that I'm busy doing now. So I'm looking at the use of technology not as an end in of itself, but to ask myself key questions around accessibility, not only in terms of the rural divide, but also in terms of people who are differently abled. I'm also looking at cultural relevance, and I'm also looking at kind of political legitimacy.
Sheila, it's been a very, very enjoyable conversation for me. Thank you very much for agreeing to interview, and thank you too for sharing your work and being a legend of online learning.
Well, thank you very much.
You can learn more about Sheryl and her work from our website. Her Twitter handle is SherylHW. That concludes this episode. Be sure to go to our website, www.onlinelearninglegends.com, to follow up on this episode's guest. You'll also find links to others whose ideas continue to inspire and teach online learning professionals, and you can subscribe to future interviews. If you know of a leader or legend we've not yet talked to, please do drop us a line at onlinelearninglegends@gmail.com.